It's The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano.
Is there a person that doesn't immediately know what this is the theme song to? If you think about it, how many TV programs can you instantly, with one or two chords, recognize the theme song? I suspect very few. But thus is the case with this particular show. And if there's any sort of a theme song that immediately puts you in the mood for something that's mind-expanding, mind-altering, something that may cause you to scratch your head, something that may cause you to think, something that may cause you to look within your own self, or look at other dimensions whose limit are only those of the imagination, it's The Twilight Zone, a show that would begin with a narrator who we would come to know, smoking a cigarette generally, saying something like this.
You're traveling through another dimension. A dimension not only of sight and sound, but of mind. A journey into a wondrous land whose boundaries are that of imagination. Your next stop, The Twilight Zone.
And then immediately, you would be prepared for a half hour, except for one season, then it was an hour, of being amazed. Somebody that has studied this, written about it, and seems to be one of the finest experts on anything resembling The Twilight Zone there is Dr. Don Presnell, the director of the Common Reading Program and a senior lecturer at Appalachian State University. He's also the co-author of A Critical History of Television's The Twilight Zone from 1959 to 1964. Don, thanks so much for joining me on the radio. I know it's a tough hour.
No, thank you, brother. This is awesome. Thank you for such an intro. I'm so excited. Thanks for reaching out to me.
Well, sure thing. Thank you. Hey, what sparked your interest in The Twilight Zone initially? What made you a fan of the series, and what made you decide to devote so much of your work and your time to researching it and writing about it?
You know, I've thought about that a lot, and I can remember, and this will date me a little bit, but I can remember being in eighth grade language arts class once upon a time. And this was the days of even pre-VCR. This was like, the reel-to-reel projector, you know, that you had to thread up and all that good stuff. And I remember the teacher showing us an occurrence at Owl Creek Bridge, an episode with no dialogue at all. And that really stuck with me. And at the time, I probably knew of The Twilight Zone, but I didn't know it in any real detail. And then I can't time stamp it exactly, but probably a few years later, again, this is pre-everything, when you got like three channels on the TV. I'm pretty sure it was probably a late Saturday night or two. I'm sure some station ran the show in varying degrees. And I can remember The Masks, a later episode, I think, from season 5, and a really lesser-known episode called A Piano in the House, which is thematically. And, you know, it kind of stayed planted there for a really long time. And as fate would have it, I was working at McFarland Publishing, and the guy I shared an office with, we just, you know, during the day we would chat, and we had a shared passion for that show, and, you know, we pitched a proposal, and they took it. And so, you know, it came out in 98. It's been a really long time since I wrote that particular book. I wrote a different book last year, but we could talk about that.
Sure, I'll ask you about that as well. What is, as far as you're concerned, what made The Twilight Zone unique? I mean, there were anthology shows that aired before that. There have been shows that aired after that that kind of tried to mimic that format. But what was it about that particular version of the original Twilight Zone that made it such a unique program?
I think one of the biggest things is Serling had a vision, and even he didn't know where it was going to go. But first and foremost, Rod Serling was a writer, and he wrote a lot in radio, and he wrote a lot of what we call golden age of television in the 50s. There were a ton of television dramas in the 50s, and he became one of the premier writers of those before Twilight Zone. So he wasn't an overnight success like kind of people tend to imagine. He put in the time and the grunt work, and you probably heard this phrase before about other shows. It was a writer's show. So he and what I call the big three, Rod Serling, Richard Matheson, Charles Beaumont, wrote the lion's share of the episodes. Later into the series, a guy your listeners, I'm sure, would recognize as Earl Hamner Jr., creator and narrator of The Waltons. He contributed four or five episodes, not surprisingly, with a kind of a rural kind of a feel to them. But they were lofty without trying to be lofty, you know, like my goodness. He tackled the show tackled, you know, time travel, racism, hypocrisy, the threat of nuclear war, right there in the middle, you know, right around, you know, the Cuban Missile Crisis of all things, and the anthology format too can't be overstated, because it gives you a certain freedom where a continuous narrative, you know. Just wouldn't allow you to do that. And Serling was a big social critic, and that just has so many shades of meaning that are different.
Sure.
Today in the Twitter age, you know, it was nothing like that. I mean, he really was heartfelt about a lot of things, and he wrote about it, and he wanted to make change, and it was from the heart, I guess. He didn't do anything to please an audience or a sponsor. As a matter of fact, the more you learn about the Twilight Zone, the more you realize Rod Serling couldn't stand sponsors because they kind of had more power than he thought they should have.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that. The when you talk about comparing the Twilight Zone to other anthology series, I think one of the other better known ones is probably The Outer Limits, but there were a bunch of others. What separated the Twilight Zone? Was it that the commentary that Rod Serling was injecting into the episodes? Was it unique in that instance, or was it something else? What made it different from, say, The Outer Limits?
I think you're right on it. You know, Outer Limits was a lot more like sci-fi genre, and there's nothing wrong with that, right? But it was genre specific. Another piece. I get tickled sometimes because people ask, like, yeah, you remember that episode with the, you know, the giant mad-eating octopus, or I don't know, just something like that. And I'll say, that wasn't the Twilight Zone.
Right.
Yeah, it was. I'm like, no, it wasn't. It was either Alfred Hitchcock Presents, The Outer Limits, or the Boris Karloff horror kind of anthology called Thriller. But it's kind of, it's almost like a Trojan horse, like the show didn't come out and say, hey, we're going to talk about, you know, discrimination or something like that. It presented, you know, like one of my favorites is The Monsters Are Due on Maple Street. I mean, if you pin me down and said, what was one of your favorites? What is a representative Twilight Zone? I would say that one.
Oh, I love that one, too. And that is just a classic. And I think the ending narration by Rod Serling in that episode really sums up the whole series in 37 seconds better than almost any episode there is.
Yeah. Very good. Yes. I didn't realize
you were... Bombs and explosions. The tools of conquest do not necessarily come with bombs and explosions and fallout. There are weapons that are simply thoughts, attitudes, prejudices, to be found only in the minds of men. For the record, prejudices can kill, and suspicion can destroy, and a thoughtless, frightened search for a scapegoat has a fallout all of its own, for the children and the children yet unborn. And the pity of it is that these things cannot be confined to the Twilight Zone.
Talking with Don Presnell, he's the author, the co-author of the book, A Critical History of Television's The Twilight Zone. Don, remind us, what was Rod Serling doing before The Twilight Zone? Where was he writing? What was he doing professionally?
earlier he saw action in World War II, and if you read any of the biographies, there are two older biographies, and there's one that came out 2 or 3 years ago that I haven't gotten around to, but I just about guarantee he would cover this as well. He saw some like really, really horrible stuff, like well-known documented stuff in World War II. So that you'll see a lot of that come through some of his more charged, I guess we'd say, episodes. And I'm pretty sure he was writing radio dramas for a while, maybe even in Cincinnati, I'm wanting to say. He's from, like, Binghamton, New York. But somehow I think he ended up, doing radio dramas, and he kind of cut his teeth on that. And then in the 50s, like I said, he and, Patty Chayefsky, and I forget some of the other, Reginald Rose, maybe some other writers in the 50s were just grinding out these dramas, Playhouse 90, Desilu Playhouse, and man, they were the rage. And he won a handful of Emmys for those before he even, thought of the Twilight Zone.
And obviously the season of the Five that certainly stands out is season four. That's the only one that has hour-long episodes instead of 30-minute episodes. A lot of the episodes look a little bit different, and they don't kind of fit with the rest of the series. Let me ask you the question I so often get when discussing the show. What happened with season four? Why was season four different from the others?
Well, if you kind of take a step back, there's kind of a I hate when people do this, but I'm going to do it. It's kind of a two-part thing. So if you look back to, I think it was season two, and this is another thing that drove Serling crazy, networks being corporate entities and that type of thing, they're like, hey, we need to save money. So in season two, you'll see a small batch of episodes that look like somebody just turned on a big clunky camera and followed the actors around in a single room. And that's pretty much literally what it was. It was shot on, like, videotape. Like, it totally doesn't have that beautiful, classic, black and white. It's still black and white, but it just doesn't have that beautiful look to it, However, one or two of those still works amazingly, and it actually helps some of those particular episodes. But, that's always a concern, corporate sponsorship, and we got to save money and that type of thing. And as the series moves on and Serling kind of, encounters and, kind of fights battles, so to speak, he gets kind of tired and he probably loses a little more interest, maybe more in the last season than any, but certainly that frustration and maybe lack of interest maybe started to creep in on season four. And I don't remember the exact reason, but I'd be just about sure that would still be a part of it, that the network was wanting to monkey around with things and change it up a little bit.
And let's talk about season five. I've read, and I learned this actually from your book, that it was poised to be canceled going into season five. It was saved at the last minute. It was on some uncertainty whether Rod Serling was going to come back. What was the behind-the-scenes drama going into season five, Don?
I hate to repeat myself, but I really think he was just kind of losing steam. Now you don't want to make light of it. He died really young. He died like age 49 or something like that. Smoked like a freight train. Didn't really take care of himself at all. And if you look at the output of the 156 episodes, he wrote like 90 some. I mean, it's crazy. You can't even imagine the stamina it would take to write them, let alone write really, really good stories. And so I think he was just tired, and you see this in any series, no matter what it is. You'll see in later, the longer a series runs, inevitably, I don't know if I'd go so far as to say they start running out of ideas, but for lack of a better phrase, they start running out of ideas. And so you'll start seeing a little of a return, and that certainly happens in this case with the Twilight Zone.
Rod Serling, although he did die young, he did work after The Twilight Zone. I know he did the Night Gallery, which was a terrific show, very similar to The Twilight Zone in a lot of respects, although it was in color and, you know, a little bit more of a grittier, darker story from time to time. Did Rod Serling do anything else after The Twilight Zone that that you found to be noteworthy?
What a coincidence. I am glad you asked that, because this is in the category of things you can't make up. So Twilight Zone goes off the air in 1964, the very next year on CBS. And some of you older viewers may have heard about this. The rest, everybody else will be like, I have never heard of that. That sounds really weird or interesting, and it's both. He did a Western.
You're kidding.
And it was Lloyd Bridges, Jeff Bridges' dad. And it was called The Loner. And it only lasted one season. And you can imagine why. You know, you're just coming out of the heyday of the Westerns. There were like scads of Westerns on the air. And at this time, around 65, you know, Bonanza's still around and Gunsmoke and that type of thing. But for the most part, the really big swell of Westerns has gone away, so that worked against it, and you know what's going to happen. Serling wants to make some really strong thematic statements, just like he did in Twilight Zone, and you know a lot, not me, I'd love that, but a lot of viewers like, what is this? We don't want this. We want shootings and you know that kind of stuff. And so it only lasted a season. But yeah,
I can't believe I didn't know about that. I'm a big Lloyd Bridges fan as well, and certainly a Rod Serling fan. I even though it sounds like the show was a little lackluster, I definitely am going to have to try and find a way to check that out. Talking with Don Presnell, author of A Critical History of Television's The Twilight Zone, 1959 to 1964. It is interesting, Don, that you specify the years. In the book title, there have been three other versions of The Twilight Zone. You had that version that aired in the late 80s, early 90s, then another version that aired in the early 2000s on UPN9, and then another version that aired just a couple of years ago on the Paramount Network, hosted by Jordan Peele. I'm sure you've watched at least episodes from all three of those other series. How do you think those three other series, those other three versions of The Twilight Zone, stack up?
Well, Frank, at the risk of embarrassing myself, I'll be honest with you, I really haven't. I know a lot
really?
About them.
Wow.
I've just never taken that dive. I mean, the temptation was there when I did The Twilight Zone book, but obviously I was like, you know, I want to focus on what I know. I know the 80s, while generally dismissed, in retrospect, it's one of those that with time, I think people are starting to kind of have a little more respect for as time goes on. You can see, I think Bruce, a really young Bruce, pre-Moonlighting Bruce Willis, makes an appearance in the 80s version. And I think the 80s version was smart enough to only, and I can't remember which episode it was, but they only like did a remake of a previous episode like maybe once or no
right.
more.
Right, that
two.
Was rare, yeah. Yeah, I think it was right. The episode a Game of Pool that they did kind of a remake of. In terms of, you know, the Twilight Zone, one of the constant themes is we saw, and this is before Star Trek, this is before we even went to the moon, but we saw so many episodes dealing with space travel, the loneliness of space travel, the different cultures that you might encounter on other planets, aliens coming to this planet. For instance, the episode Elegy.
To peace, my friends. To everlasting, eternal peace.
Space was a big theme on The Twilight Zone, wasn't it?
Yes. Yes, and that's great you picked that. That's a Charles Beaumont episode, and it's really creepy, too. I don't want to give anything away to your listeners, but, yeah, that's a great choice. Yeah, you know, one of the cool things just on a surface level about the show is I call it like a time capsule feature, you know? You can look back and see, you know, you can pick up on what was culturally in the moment at that time. And like you said, we're 10 years away from the moon landing and all that stuff. So it's really neat to see that. But, you know, when it all gets down to it, You know, it's about two big super home run themes of the series are, you know, alienation and self-identity or loss of that identity and fear. And I know those are broad, but I think maybe going back to one of your earlier questions, I think that's why it works, because the themes are so universal in a non right. English class kind of way that people kind of relate to it, no matter if you're seeing rotary phones or pay phones on the screen, you still relate to that.
Yeah, no, I would certainly agree. There are obviously all the episodes of The Twilight Zone generally have some sort of a twist where, you know, the big ending, there's a big reveal where we learn something about one of the characters or the story or something. Once you've seen that episode, though, once you know the twist, once you know it's a cookbook, once you know the faces of the pig people, for instance, do the episodes rerun well, in your view? Certainly a show like Seinfeld, you could watch the episodes 1,000 times and the jokes are still funny. A show that's generally a bit less comedic but relies on those twists at the end, like The Twilight Zone, can you watch an episode of The Twilight Zone repeatedly and still get something out of it?
I would argue for the most part, yes. For those same reasons, you know, it's like when you have a favorite movie and you know, whoever you're watching it with is just astounded that you can quote the whole thing and you know what's coming and that kind of thing. For instance, when I do my Twilight Zone iteration of first year seminar here at Appalachian State, the pilot episode, Where Is Everybody? Usually pilot episodes for any series in retrospect are kind of clunky and they're still trying to figure things out. Not in this one. It's one of the top 10 episodes for me, and I see something new in it every time.
Really? Really? There were a number of terrific actors that starred in The Twilight Zone before superstardom. Obviously, William Shatner is in two terrific episodes. Robert Duvall is in a great episode. Robert Redford is in a great episode. Dennis Hopper is in a great episode. As far as actors that became stars later on, other than the ones that I just mentioned, is there anybody that specifically stands out in your brain?
Oh, goodness. Wow. Well, there's one, but it doesn't really, like, it's not really it's not his fault. It's just it is what it is. But a really young Burt Reynolds is in a season 4 episode called The Bard, where Shakespeare.
Oh, yeah. I had forgotten that he was in that.
Yeah. And it's kind of a not too veiled take on Marlon Brando at the time.
Yeah. That is very funny. I'm going to have to rewatch that episode. That episode is one of the few Twilight Zone episodes that is uncharacteristically funny. Most of the other episodes are dramatic or they're dark. There's a handful that are pretty funny. That's one. What's another episode or two that is a much funnier version of the Twilight Zone than we generally hear?
Yeah. Let's see. Gosh, it's been a while since I've looked at all the titles. There's an episode, I think it's season 1, and it's a baseball episode, and it's about a pitcher named Casey, I believe it is.
Oh, yeah, that's with Jack Warden.
Jack Warden, yeah. Yeah, Frank, you're awesome.
Well, no, I don't know about that, is funny.
And, it actually plays in with that theme of technology, and of course, it's the time capsule thing again, right? At that time, and baseball is my favorite sport. That's another reason I
Same.
Love that.
No, absolutely. I'm with you on that. Hey, this might be a difficult question or an unfair question, but if you had to pick your least favorite episode of The Twilight Zone, what would it be?
I'm going to lightly defer. Let me tell you what it used to be, and it probably I need to go back because it's been a really long time since I've seen it. But I know when I was doing the book, I remember watching the very last episode. It was called The Bewitching Pool, and I referred to this earlier. It was written by Earl Hamner Jr. You know, and I can't remember the particulars. I just thought isn't really that good. But, you know, I'd have to go back because I actually had a student or two a few years ago. They're like, oh, that's my favorite. I was like, really? You know, so, I would say that one on the spot, but I've got a feeling if I went back and watched that one, it's probably not as bad as I remember, and I'm glancing at the appendix from my book here to see if anything jumps out at me. That's the only one I can really come up with. Like I tell my students, I was like, listen, even a bad Twilight Zone is better than what you'll get from a lot of other TV shows.
That's for sure. Hey, is there any truth to the rumor that the original choice to be the narrator on the show was not Rod Serling but Orson Welles?
You know, I can't remember. I can tell you this, though, and you can see this on, like, a DVD and Blu-ray set. He was not going to be the narrator, period. They've got another version of the pilot where the intro is spoken by a booming voice actor type, and his name escapes me right now. So you can actually see that on one of the...
Really? I'm going to have to check that one out. Hey, this has been a lot of fun, Don. I hope we can chat again soon. I appreciate it very much. And if people want to check out either this book or your new book, what's the best way for them to do that?
Well, the easiest is to go to Amazon, but, you know, I'm not going to hawk my books here. But if you can go to drdonp.com. It's a blog that I really need to do more work on. But it does have a page of the books I've written, which is this one, last year, a book I wrote about the classic The Wild Wild West, which was my other all-time
book. Terrific. Terrific. Don, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Frank. Thank you so much. What a nice surprise. Hey, have a great...
The pleasure's all mine. Have a good weekend. Thank you. If you want to comment on any portion of our conversation, you can give me a call, 800-848-9222. That's 800-848-9222. This is The Other Side of Midnight. Straight ahead.
My name is Talkie Tina. And you'd better be nice to me.
The Other Side of Midnight.